gold, frankincense, or myrrh?
Oh, I wonder what these could be.
It's Epiphany! Officially now, according to the church calendar.
Oh, I wasn't sure if you were saying the church calendar or if this was suddenly a moment where you realized what these things were.
Yeah. I was like, oh, yeah.
Sorry.
All
bad pun.
Coming together.
Terrible pun.
It's okay. I shared the on my Facebook. I shared that comic, the Breakfast at Epiphany's.
Yeah, I saw that.
Okay. So, gold, frankincense,
or
myrrh.
Mm-hmm.
Myrrh is the one that smells really good, isn't it? Or is that frankincense?
They both smell good.
Oh gosh, I don't remember what the smell qualities of frankincense and myrrh are.
You know what
gold smells great.
I was gonna say, you know what gold is, right?
Tasty, tasty metal.
But knowing you and how much you love, and how much you love fancy cooking things, you're probably thinking of like edible gold leaf.
I mean, that is the thing that exists, but I would not spend the amount of money that it costs to get edible gold things. Fun fact, there's like a $1,000 plate of wings in New York City where they coat the fried chicken in gold.
Okay. That's, I mean, that is a thing
cool.
you could
That's
do.
That's like the most cool. New York thing I've said all day. Anyway.
Something tells me that's the only New York thing you've said all day.
Yes, that is also true. So, back to Epiphany. Frankincense, myrrh.
Gold, frankincense, or myrrh. Pick one. I thought this was a simple one.
No, I'm just trying to remember the smell properties. That's all I'm trying to remember.
I don't... figure it out based off of... I'm not your Google.
I will go with... I think frankincense is the one that I typically like. So frankincense.
Okay.
Decision made. Kyle.
I don't think I've ever smelled either.
Really?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Not even with everyone going crazy about essential oils and stuff?
No. I mean, my mom uses them, but it's usually like lavender and, you know, slightly more common things that I've definitely smelled before. So let's just go with gold because I don't know what the other two smell like and they might be atrocious and I wouldn't know. I assume not because that would be a terrible thing to give to baby Jesus, but...
Frankincense, according to the Googles, is a warm, sweet, and woodsy smell, whereas myrrh... is earthy with slight licorice notes.
Yeah, because it's a resin. And Ooh. you can put it in your wine and it's still drinkable if you want like a really perfumey wine.
You said the word licorice and now my answer might be changing.
Oh, I don't know. How much of a freak you are for licorice.
I'll go find and smell it and then we'll come back to it. What's that?
I said I forgot how much of a freak you are for licorice.
Just a little bit. I like my licorice.
I just remember the last time I looked into your tea drawer and it was like half of it was licorice-based tea.
Licorice spice, yeah.
All of the disgusting
That's
tea.
Me. You know what? To each his own, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
You can have crappy tastes and I'll have good ones. It's fine.
Sometimes you just can't fix bad taste, Kyle.
I know. I've tried. I've tried convincing you guys, but...
Ashley.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, okay. Depending on the amount of gold being given, I think I'm going to take gold because then I can buy whatever amounts of frankincense of myrrh I would prefer. And then I get all three.
Ah, so you're just going to hack this or that.
Wow. Yeah, why do you think I created this question?
Cheat codes.
Basically. Up, up, down, down, left, right, left, right.
Start select. You always have to end with one of those. Come on.
Not always.
Not a Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. Most of the ones I ever played.
What are you implying there, Kyle?
that I probably played crappy video games, all right? Let's move on.
Hello, everyone. This is episode 124 of the Min-Max podcast, and we are officially in Epiphany.
Well, yeah, it's Epiphany today, and then progressive Sundays after this, it's the Sunday
first
after.
Sunday after Epiphany. Second Sunday after Epiphany.
Yeah.
And we've just finished, what, the 23rd Sunday after Pentecost? Something like that?
No, Christmas. There are 12 days of Christmas.
That's right. I was thinking of, obviously, the last Sunday of Pentecost. I was not...
Right, but I don't know why, because we weren't in Pentecost.
That is a valid point. Anywho. So, we're just going to gloss over my bad memory of the church calendar and just keep right on trucking along.
I was happy to do that. You're the one that keeps bringing it up.
I mean, sometimes I got to call it myself. So, Ashley, you had a really good topic idea that came from our first Patreon subscription question thing. Why am I making this more difficult than it is?
I think Leon's glitching.
Yeah. He's struggling.
Buffer.
I mean, to be fair, we don't typically record on Mondays, but we were all feeling terrible on Sunday, so it's just better. It's just better to take a break. So it's like a non-traditional both recording and release schedule. And that's probably a heads up for anybody who listened to our last episode. It's good to note that our release schedules are going to be kind of wonky for the next, like for January and February, as we move back and then potentially move again. So just be patient with us as we navigate that. But topic for today was sent in by Skip Clark, one of our Patreon subscribers, one of the first to hit the tier that allows for Patreon subscribers to suggest a topic or ask a question. And his question was this: why are so many of us as Christian gamers drawn to dark settings such as Cthulhu, Ravenloft, etc.? And I think that's an excellent question. And the more I contemplated it, the more I realized that, especially during the winter months, I'm much more drawn to spooky tales, even more so than I am around Halloween, as much as I love Halloween. And I think because Halloween is just one day that people just don't like to build up to, and it bums me out. So I just end up getting excited for Halloween, and then no one wants to celebrate it, so I'm just sad. Whereas like winter, everyone's in a bad and spooky mood because it's dark all the time, especially in Scotland.
Yep.
So I watch the majority of like my sad and spooky things during the winter. I mean, I made Alan watch Hereditary, and he hates me for it, so.
Yep. Yeah, there was a series of days where she's like, spoopy movie? And I'm like, enough of these already. It's not that I don't like them, I just, they're not my go-to cup of tea.
Yeah, comedy and horror, just not your things.
No, not particularly.
But it made me dig into, because I know that this is it's not just me, right, that enjoys spooky things during the winter. That comes from somewhere, because I've heard other people express this as well. And it made me think of the Shakespeare play Winter's Tale, in which a character actually says a sad tale is best for winter, and then he mentioned something about his tale having like ghosts and goblins and stuff in it. And then I later found out in the Victorian era there was a tradition of, especially around Christmas, telling one another ghost stories around the fire. Mm-hmm. And they had these really terrifying and weird cards that had like bugs doing the waltz and like comic scenes of people in ghost costumes scaring people in the parlor while they were telling a ghost story, like really weird stuff. And I just thought it was really interesting and kind of cool because it fits with the season of it being dark and of things dying, that we are in that mood to contemplate death more, because that's just the actual, you know, natural season we're in, is when all these things die.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept of Christmas ghosts, and, you know, like I just said, we're out of the Christmas season now. It's Epiphany, and then we'll beginning into ordinary time. But this idea that you, even without meaning to, the natural seasons sort of bend us to or incline us to thinking about things like death or the end. And I think one of the reasons why we're so compelled by that is because it's the one last sort of human experience that any of us talking or listening today has yet to experience. So it's still one of the great mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't surprise me that anybody, but especially Christians, would be kind of compelled by that, even if, you know, you don't want to admit to it. It's something that is interesting. And I know that we've talked about that a little bit on the podcast before, but wanted to open it up to you guys to see what you thought or any of the settings that Skip listed here, Cthulhu, Ravenloft, etc., if any of those were ones that you had experiences with, and if so, any stories that came from those.
I know I have a little bit of experience with Ravenloft, because one of the last games that I ran was when we were still living in Westmont, and I had begun to transition us into Ravenloft. We'd been doing just kind of a one-shot-to-one-shot type of campaign adventure for the property we were at, and the last session, you guys walked into a big bank of fog, and suddenly you weren't where you thought you were, and you came out and you saw the Castle Ravenloft in front of you. So I did a little bit of research on it there. And I do hear you. As we get past the Halloween time period, I do notice that I do start kind of craving that type of movie or that type of media more.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it is the gateway to start it. Like, Halloween is like, yes, we can watch this, and then we can, there's so many movies. So like, to keep with the vampires, like 30 Days of Night, mm-hmm, kicks in for me, which, if you have not watched that film, it is fantastic. It is great vampire. It is great vampire story, it's just a lot of fun. It also happens to be winter, which is also a tiny plot.
Yeah, that's true.
Tiny plot summary: it takes place in Alaska, where there are 30 days of night, and a vampire coven descends on a small town and basically tries to wipe out the whole small town in those 30 days when no one can go out, where it's just dark all day and no one wants to go outside anyway. So the whole town's cut off. Vampires come in to do their vampire thing. Josh Hartnett's, and it's pretty, it's pretty fantastic.
Whatever happened to that guy?
He does some work every now and again. He's kind of gone quiet recently. He hasn't done a ton. At least to my knowledge, I could be missing something blatantly obvious in front of me. But, yeah. So, Cthulhu, I have less experience with. I played the Cthulhu games. I recently bought the whole compendium of What's His Bucket.
H.P. Lovecraft.
H.P. Lovecraft, thank you. I bought his entire audiobook set.
Yeah, and your Audible account looked like a serial killer's.
Yes, we have discussed this before, because it was three murder mysteries, that, Dune, and
a ton of H.P. Lovecraft.
And
yeah.
H.P. Lovecraft. Ashley just started getting the notifications because we had some credits to burn before the month was out, and she didn't have anything. She's like, okay, I'm going to buy some stuff that I'm interested in. And suddenly she just looked over, it's just like, should I be concerned? Yeah, so I've been meaning to go through and start listening to it. I just haven't had a chance to yet. So I don't have tons of experience with the Cthulian? How do we refer to the Cthulhu?
I think it's typically
setting
referred to as just Lovecraftian.
Lovecraftian?
I was going to say, yeah. I don't refer to it.
you just void it out in your mind.
I've tried, because I know there was a point in which, because we listened to audiobooks before bed, while we're trying to sleep, and we listened to, which one was it? You'd put something on that was Lovecraft. And like, I usually drift off to sleep more comfortably when we're listening to something, but this put me out cold. Because I was bored. I just couldn't get into it. I was just like, and it might've been the narrator or something, but it just wasn't gripping me. I mean, I don't like Lovecraft as a person. So I just have a hard time like motivating myself to try.
I mean, that's fair. Like, if it's not your bag, it's not your bag. You don't have to like everything, as Kyle is so noted with tea. Kyle, what about you? What about your experiences with these?
So Lovecraft, I have listened to a handful of audiobooks. There's actually a short period when I was in seminary, one of the trips that I was taking back and forth, I had downloaded a bunch of Lovecraft audiobooks, and I was listening to a couple of the stories. It was kind of one of those things where, like, I kind of lost focus too, and I realized I would rather be reading them. But what I was attentive to, I enjoyed for the most part. I kind of like what he does with it. I kind of like where he goes with it, sort of the poetic language and the, like, air of mystery without necessarily being, like, a deep need to solve it kind of mystery, because that's where it would really lose me, I think. But more than that, I love, like, classic gothic horror, and I've talked about this before, things like Dracula, Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde, those stories. Yeah, I'm all for it. I love Dracula, especially, is a phenomenal book. I absolutely love that book. So, yeah, I mean, that's probably the core of what I would say I would go to for that kind of storytelling. Yeah. I don't know that I can think of any other major examples off the top of my head.
What draws you to, I guess, Dracula first? Like, what do you love about that novel in particular?
For one thing, the writing. I mean, I think the writing is very well done. I think the characters are very compelling, and I think it's... So I've talked about, you know, with things like a lot of mysteries and a lot of things like serial dramas or really, like, political type stories, I just don't get into, because I don't like all of the... like, the constant shifting... Oh, it's this person. No, it's actually this person. No, it's, you know, and just like the weird web of stuff that always tends to happen with a lot of those stories, I'm not a fan of. But I do like the sort of like tense, dark undertones that come into play with stories like that. And that's what I think Dracula does really well, where it's not really a mystery, but just there's that nice touch of suspense that's in play that really helps sort of make it come alive in a sense, I guess. That, and I like classic novels as it is. I like the language, I like the style in a lot of cases.
Sure.
So I just kind of appreciate, you know, being able to, it's heady ultimately, you know, it's very exploratory into human character and vice and ideas of morality and things like that. And I think that's one of the things I enjoy the most about it.
So what do we think that it actually is? So, like, I could dig into a little bit more, but I feel like why I like those settings. But I feel like the bigger question to answer here is, why do we feel like we keep getting drawn back to these, and especially as people of faith? I know, Ashley, that's kind of where you're gearing.
Well, yeah, and that's why I brought up the mystery of death. Like, when I was reading more up on this, I realized that last year was the first time I'd ever read and listened to Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which is a really great story. If you haven't read it or listened to it, it's I don't want to be hyperbolic, but it's phenomenal. It's just really well-crafted and, like, just profoundly sad. Like, Alan, I was listening to it and before bed that year, and Alan turns to me, he's like, why do we have to listen to this sad story? And he hadn't been around when I'd been listening to it earlier, so he had no context for what was happening. He could just immediately pick up on the fact that it was a very sad story, and it is, but it's also it also really highlights this concept of death, you know, being one of the last great mysteries. And it's interesting too, because there are three central characters that read a lot like the Trinity, which I find really compelling. And it's like one of those, it's sad in the sense of like a coming of age sort of story of something is lost, but something else is gained. And you have to decide whether the thing that is gained is commensurate with what's lost. Right. which I think is why I like coming of age stories a lot, because it compels me to think about the value of intangible things. And I do think that these sorts of sad or spooky sort of darker material things helps us reframe death in ways that help us contemplate them more with more depth. Like with Dracula, what's it like to be immortal? And what does that immortality cost? And you know, what does it mean to be human? Those are all questions I think are compelling and necessary for Christians to contemplate. So, you know, they have a sense of their own creed, for lack of better phrase, or Christian ethics. You know, what does it mean to be human, and how do we treat and recognize the humanity in others? These are all questions that come up. Cthulhu, I don't know much more about. My only recent exposure to Cthulhu or the concept of Cthulhu or Lovecraftian horror would be with Bird Box, which is on Netflix.
Mm.
Which, Kyle, have you seen Bird Box yet?
I haven't.
Okay,
no.
I wasn't sure. It's scarier than I anticipated, considering you never actually see the monster. Mm. I would say it's more suspenseful than anything, and I thought it was interesting. Like there was a, you know, a whole series of memes and jokes that came out of that movie, but I think that just highlights its success in what it did more than anything, because people are talking about it. But it does really emphasize the concept of the unknown that I think Christians are often consumed by, for, you know, as strong as your faith is, there is still this element of the unknown and the mysterious, and that's okay. But it still doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about it. And I think some of my favorite conversations have been with people who are just kind of wondering at things and are allowing themselves to wonder at things. And that's why I think horror, or the horrible are interesting story mechanics or story settings, because it doesn't, you know, tidy things up.
Yeah, there's something about darkness in the way that it deals with human beings as finite, mm-hmm. that always does cause interesting things to come out. And you hear like all sorts of stories about people hanging on, like people who are actually near death, hanging on to see that one person,
mm-hmm.
and one person walks in the room and suddenly it's like peace washes over.
Yeah.
And then within days, sometimes hours, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something I think I like about dark novels, dark fantasy, dark story in general, whether it's fictional or fantasy, that, or fictional reality rather, that forces you to wrestle with that. I think I agree with you, Ashley, that there's something about the wrestling with the unknown,
mm-hmm.
that is quite compelling. You'd mentioned when you were describing liking the darkness, mm-hmm. For lack of a better phrase, you used a phrase that was exploring the humanity and forces, mm-hmm. you to explore the humanity. It actually made it ticked to an animated series that we've watched that actually does that with Dracula, and that's Castlevania.
I freaking love Castlevania so much. Yeah. So good.
Kyle, have you seen Castlevania?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
You would love it.
You will love it. So it's fantastic. And the whole second season, I won't be spoilery or anything, but the whole second season, you see both humans and Dracula wrestling with Dracula's humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of his own humanity, what he, in that world or in this tale, what he gave up or what he was willing to give up to be in love, what happened because of said love, and how he is now wrestling with having loved, and everyone coming in and thinking they know what he's going through, whether that's other vampires or the human beings that he's interacted with, and suddenly those things aren't matching up. And so it's a really, I don't know if I want to go quite so far as to say beautiful, but I think it is a really well done.
I think it's beautiful. It's beautifully animated, if anything. Some of the fight scenes in that, I mean, you know, fight choreography, it's difficult in itself, but then to seamlessly animate combat, the way they have is, yeah, I've just been so incredibly impressed. There are very few shows now where I am not preoccupied with another activity while watching, and that is a show that I can actually watch without being preoccupied by something else. It's just that good.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that you guys are describing is a lot of what's compelling about the novel, too, because the novel explores a lot of those same themes and that kind of thing. As you guys were just talking, I was kind of thinking about one of the characters. I mean, he's probably my favorite character in the book, and it's so bizarre to me how pop culture has taken and morphed him, but Van Helsing. In the novels, yeah. Van Helsing is, I mean, he's a doctor, he's a professor, and he's like, he's portrayed as like this, like, kind of an adorable, slightly dopey, but very kind, very wise older man who is just sort of put in this circumstance, and you kind of see him in the novel wrestling through, like, the morality of dealing with Dracula and the fact that, you know, like, when I want to say it's Lucy. I can't remember which of the characters is turned by Dracula, but when there's this scene where he basically is telling everybody else, like, no, like, she's going to wake up and she's going to be like him. We have to put her down. And he takes it upon himself to behead her and stuff her mouth with garlic and, like, go through this, like, ritual. Like, he's the guy who knows how to do all this stuff. And it's this kind of dark moment where you see, like, him owning up to it, like, okay, I'm the person who knows how to do this, so I'll do it. And it's going to be horrible. You know, I hate everything about this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to, you know, disfigure this woman. I don't want to, you know, go through this process. So you see him wrestling through a lot of the consequences of those kinds of things too, which is so much more compelling to me, despite the fact that, yeah, turning him into, like, this cool vampire hunter figure is all fine and good, but it's like you've lost, I mean, they completely disregard everything about the nature of that character in a lot of, like, more modern, you know, renditions of it. It's also, I think, what Frankenstein does the best. Because Mary Shelley just captures that so perfectly in looking at the dichotomy of Victor Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster. And it's so fascinating that, you know, in the end of that novel, the thing you come to find is that the monster is far more human than Dr. Frankenstein ever was. You know, he's so much more relatable as a character, and the monologues and things that he has are just so human. They're so real, and the struggles that he feels are the thing that, like, really captures the essence of I feel like what she was trying to get at with that novel. And despite the fact that he has this sort of semi-Hulk-esque struggle of, I'm the monster and I've killed people and I didn't really mean to necessarily, but it was, you know, what I had to do to survive kind of thing. Whereas, you know, Victor, on the other hand, is just, you just sort of see him descend further and further into, you know, making more and more terrible choices, and being less and less of a likable person as the novel goes on. That, and I just love the way it's written with regard to, like, it being written in the form of, like, letters between people and stuff like that. Yeah. I feel like I love that style so much.
I keep going back to trying to think about what it is about death that causes us to be reflective, and why we keep being drawn back to these things. Because obviously, in popular culture, we're obsessed with it. Like, The Walking Dead is huge for various reasons, but at the core of it, I mean, it is the world has gone mad, post-apocalyptic. Everything is dead except a few humans, which are the Walking Dead. And so there's lots of wrestling that goes on with what happens to society in a situation like that, and how do you continue to have humanity in the midst of monstrosity. You have, I mean, all of these different settings that we've been talking about are apocalyptic in some manner or the other. So Cthulian, gosh darn it, Lovecraftian, I keep wanting to make it something else, is in every story that we hear in all the games that I've ever played, you go crazy. Like, you start to lose your own sanity, question what is real, and you're lucky if you make it out alive. And I'm just trying to think about what it is about this particular topic, or this particular setting and things that make it so compelling and why we keep coming back to it. And especially as Christians, we tend to come back to this a lot. There's a lot of people who spend a whole lot of time thinking about death and why it is that we keep getting drawn back to it.
I think a lot of American religion is sometimes caught off guard by death because of the cultural propensity to build up or amass wealth to the extent that we forget about our own mortality. A lot of things are geared towards trying to build upon legacy and longevity. I mean, if you just scroll through Instagram, a lot of influencers are you know, fixated on youth and youthful beauty. So it doesn't shock me too much when people then, once they've experienced a death, whether that's in the family or a friend or what have you, they're understandably horrified by it, but then kind of compelled by it in a lot of ways because it is a jarring experience. And I think that's at least, I think a lot of people start to grow in their both appreciation for and interest in the morose when they have experienced something like that. I think that's understandable, and I think that's a natural process to go through. And that's why I'm really appreciative of clerics and chaplains who help people grieve, like we've met, you know, Dr. Cindy Wallace, when she's talked about her work, and people who are compelled by it without, I mean, I think Dr. Cindy Wallace has experienced her fair share. But even those who gravitate towards that subject without having experienced loss themselves, I think are a special breed because they can empathize without having to have walked exactly through what's happened.
Sure.
And I'm grateful for ministers and chaplains who have the capacity for that kind of empathy, because it is hard to go through as is. But you need a calming presence in that moment that gets it, but doesn't have to be a part of it or contribute to it in any way. Apart from presence. So I think there are a lot of cultural things wrapped up in death and how we deal with it. And I think a lot of the ways that death has been discussed in some churches has been relatively unhealthy because it's been brushed aside as, you know, well, don't worry, you'll go to heaven. And that's right. Ultimately what the eschatology is surmounted to as well. You'll go to heaven. You were a good person.
Right, which for like half of the atheists and agnostics that I've ever talked to are like, so what? You know, and it, like, we haven't created a vision of an eschatological vision of heaven that seems compelling, even to some of us Christians, because we talk about it and I'm like, what does that mean? Yeah. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Like, and I've even seen like Christian authors and things like point that out and criticize that of like, so we become disembodied spirits praising God forever in heaven. Like, I'm sorry, that doesn't sound that compelling to me. If I sound blasphemous, but
exactly. Well, no. Cause that's also like to become disembodied spirits and just, you know, be happy for that. That's Gnosticism. Like there is no reconciliation wrong with God that is disembodied. Yep. That doesn't make any sense. So
yep, exactly. And that's, I mean, I pointed that out. That's specifically the criticism of authors that I've read and stuff before. I think another thing that kind of goes in hand with that a little bit is I don't think, especially in American culture, we necessarily have great rituals around death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yes.
I think there's that notion, like, A, we try to suppress it, which, as we talked about a handful of episodes ago, it's the don't talk about the elephant in the room kind of thing, right? Where we shove it down and we try not to deal with it.
Yep.
There's that whole, I mean, and it goes hand in hand with, you know, how we're expected to handle emotions a lot of the time in American culture of like, nope, don't show it. It doesn't need to be a public thing. I can't remember what class it was, but there was some seminary class where we were talking about this. And the professor pointed out, I mean, here's the thing. In American society, the expectation is that you're quiet, you're solemn, that kind of thing. Whereas in a lot of other cultures, like, they'll walk down the street with the hearse screaming and wailing. Yes. Like, it's a way to externalize their grief. And that the expectation is exactly the opposite here. And that's, in a lot of ways, unhealthy. I mean, on a psychological level, suppressing things is typically always unhealthy.
Yep. No, I would love to put it in my will to force my family to have an Irish wake in which you have to have the body. You have the body in like the living room and it's there for, I think, a week. And that it's just present while you're grieving. And then you process out to bury it. But I would really love my coffin to be elephant shaped.
Of course you would.
Just, you know, they know that I have some posthumous humor as well.
Yeah, you would.
And then you can just, like, it can be on wheels, so you can just, like, pull this giant wooden elephant behind you while you go to bury me.
So Ashley wants to be buried in a Trojan horse.
I was going to say, Trojan elephant.
Yeah, basically.
Cool.
First cool, line cool. of the will, bury me in a Trojan elephant.
Oh, dear. Now I'm just hoping you die first so I have a little bit of space to appreciate it. Hopefully not, like, much first. You know, like, 70 years down the road when we've lived very full lives.
I'm okay
but
with
still.
This.
But
Oh, dear. You can field all the questions of my family as well. Why?
Okay, so like a long, long, long time ago.
Long, long
here's what
time
happened.
Ago.
Ashley wanted to be buried in an elephant.
And that's it. That's the whole story.
Yeah. And they're going to
so
be like, yeah,
forget.
That checks.
That sounds right.
Remember your mortality and remember to grieve.
See, it's. I'm thinking about this a little bit more, and like you do in the U.S. specifically, and I know this isn't U.S. centric, so it depends on what sort of eschatological vision that you're painting. Because if you are of the death is the end, and then you at some time everyone will rise, there is also the rapture camp. And depending on which interpretation you take on this, it's either the rapture happens, everyone rises, and then Jesus immediately comes, or if you want to go the left behind route, which terrible theology, let's just put a big old flag right there and say, do not read this as a roadmap. It's terrible.
Wait, what was Satan's name in that book? Nikolai Carpathia?
Correct.
Yep.
Named after the Carpathian
Nikolai
Mountains.
Oh, that's
fun right. fact.
Nothing's more demonic than a mountain range.
them frosty peaks of hell.
Well, I mean, in Dante's Inferno.
I mean, you're not wrong. But some people look at if you were to go that terrible interpretation of the end times, mm-hmm. that it's people's chance to be Eli from the Book of Eli and defend. Yeah. And because the way that theology works is if you manage to survive into the second coming, you will be judged. And if you were found to have become a believer, it was your second chance, despite everything that you've done. And so in that series, it paints the picture of, well, we're going to defend the people who are preaching with guns, and it's going to get very scary very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's yucky.
Yeah,
it's yucky.
I think there was a pretty good, if I remember correctly, spoof of that concept in the movie This Is the End. It's got, we watched it once at my aunt's place where I forget, it's Seth Rogen and that other guy, I can never remember his name. And it is the end of the world and the earth has gone to hell. And they're being tortured and people aren't causing anarchy. But then the two main characters decide to start trying to, or they, like, one of them starts being nice to somebody and like sacrifices himself for another person. And then he starts being pulled up to heaven in like a light tube ultimately, because he's done a good deed and been sacrificial. And then he, like, as he's being pulled up to heaven, he starts cussing out the people. He's like, yeah, that's right. You know, mofos, I did blah, blah, blah. And then he starts being lowered down again because he's being a jerk. I'm pretty sure the movie is called This Is the End.
Which, of course, as a comedy, Yeah, but also not great theology.
Oh, no, not at all, because it's spoofing that terrible rapture theology. Right, it's right. Great.
I think, not to kind of derail our point, but to cycle back to something that you were talking about a little while ago, Ashley, one of the things that I was thinking about with regard to this topic is, I think one thing that dark fantasy settings can do really, really well is kind of this, like, double-edged sword of, I think, they can simultaneously, or, you know, depending on which universe you're talking about, either make morality very, very clear, or make it very, very muddy.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that these darker settings is very effective with, is it draws out these notions of ethics and morality in very different and interesting ways. And, you know, depending on what setting you're talking about, like I said, you can get instances where you have things like, well, you know, in Dracula, like it's not too questionable, I would say, that Dracula is evil. Like, mm-hmm. It's pretty clean cut. Like, no, he's evil. He needs to be taken care of. Right. Yeah. So it helps clarify morality in a way that becomes very black and white, which I think can be appealing to Christians, because that's sort of like the default we tend to want to take a lot of the time. You know, we want to engage scripture in a way that's very one-dimensional and be able to say, like, okay, so these are the, you know, take the Ten Commandments, for example. These are the 10 rules. We need to follow these 10 rules. But then there's always things like the trolley problem that start to come into play, right? Where it's like, now morality is gray and I can't make a clean cut decision anymore. And that's just the way the real world works, right? And so I think it's nice to be able to engage with those stories where we can look at it and say, okay, no, this is, in theory, the clear moral choice here. On the flip side, some of them are also very good at drawing out the gray and making it harder and harder to distinguish what's good and what's evil. And also, you know, doing that with characters to try and decide, you know, okay, is the main character of this story a good person or an evil person? Am I supposed to be rooting for this person, or do I kind of want them to get what's coming to them in the end, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Which, you know, is maybe simultaneously comforting in that it's relatable for us to be able to see someone else or relate to someone else who's struggling through the moral gray at the same time, you know? So I think, like I said, it's that double-edged sword of, you have access to kind of both sides of this, in a lot of dark settings. And, you know, depending on which appeals more to you, you might be drawn more or less to those elements.
So, I mean, which one are you drawn to more then? Because if I remember correctly, you're a high fantasy guy that typically is pretty black and white with its morality, so.
By and large, but I like, I like both, depending on how they're done.
Okay.
I think if you're gonna get into a lot of gray, it can't be everything is gray. I still need something on either end of it, right? Or at least I need characters who are genuinely doing their best to be good a lot of the time. You know, when you get into the, like, stuff where, like, everyone is questionable, there's no clean-cut hero kind of thing, like, I still need something to sort of triumphantly cut through in the end.
Yeah.
So I think about things like, I just started watching Heroes again with Jill this past weekend. And that's one of the things that I love about that show, is it dives into so many of those moral questions, and you deal with characters like Siler, who it has his moments of, like, seeming to, like, come out of it and repent of all of his evil, and then, you know, flips right back around and you're like, nope, this guy is definitely unquestionably evil at the end of the day. And then, you know, some of the other characters, like the Petrellis, Nathan and Peter, who, you know, Nathan makes much more questionable decisions throughout, but still by and large tries to do the right thing, which is still compelling. But then you have Peter and Hero, who are sort of the contrast to that, who are consistently, sure, they make mistakes, they do some things that are also kind of questionable, but at the end of the day, you know, their motives are quote unquote, and I use this loaded term, but pure.
Yeah.
Where they're, you know, they're doing their very best, their utmost to be the good guy, to be the hero in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need, you know, I need things like that, where if it's gonna, there's going to be a lot of gray, I also need at least somebody or a couple people to sort of be the moral compass.
Yeah.
In those settings too, where I can be like, okay, which I think it can be, you know, the other thing about it is, you know, it's a really, terrible phrase, but the light shines brightest in the darkness.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. Where it's, you get more triumph out of the triumphant hero when the odds are just that much worse.
Sure.
And I think that can be an appeal too.
Just saying, Peter Petrelli gets his comeuppance when he gets a little bit older. He also time travels a little bit and then turns into a good person and then adopts a kid and then, you know, turns into This Is Us, and we all know how that ends. Sorry, that was the long way around.
I was wondering where this was going.
I was wondering when you guys were going to be like, what the heck are you talking
about?
No,
I was there. It was just the silent judgment that I was trying to communicate to you.
Exactly. Yep, absolutely. What she said.
Silent judgment makes for great radio.
I feel like the audience could feel the vacant,
my
questioning
disdain.
Stares.
We'll have to put that up as a poll or something. It's like, did you feel the tension? So it's interesting that I was thinking about this a little bit, that this invades stories as well. Like this, the midwinter tension. I'm kind of reeling back to where we kind of began. So with this coming up in the darker time of year, there's definitely some novels that actually play with this a little bit too. So to be that guy... in the Rothfussian universe, there is a midwinter pageantry. It's when they do the whole thing where the where the troops go around and play up the Ancanus drama. Where Ancanus, you sound so thrilled to be talking about this.
I thought for sure we had a clear cut topic where Patrick Rothfuss nor his unfinished series would be brought up.
You thought wrong.
I clearly did.
But he plays with this too, and the battle that they set up in there of between the demons and angels of what is his name? Talos fighting Ancanus, and basically them going back and forth and Ancanus being run out of town. That is also there, and it's also in the winter. In the deep midwinter, if you will.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me too much. Patrick Rothfuss does his research. He's as big of a nerd as Neil Gaiman is. So,
yes, this is true.
You know, like, it doesn't shock me that he's influenced by Gothic literature or Victorian literature, you know, and that tradition of ghost story in the winter.
True. Sorry, I just figured this popped up and I gotta get my... You know, almost episodic Rothfussian moment in there.
It should just be a segment.
the Rothfussian minute. Rothfuss with Alan.
Yeah.
Join us next week when he talks about something else.
Yeah, just like I'm just. Rothfuss. But if we make it just a minute, then that's like one measure of time. He's limited and contained.
Right. True.
I'm okay with this. So, do we have any final thoughts? I take that as no.
The only other thing that I want to mention that I'm latching onto that you mentioned a little bit earlier, Ashley, and talking about chaplaincy and that kind of thing is I like this idea. I want to dwell on this, and that's all I'm really saying here, is the idea, you know, you're talking about chaplaincy and people, you know, engaging with this. I like the idea of, to borrow John's language a little bit, to be, now I should know this line. Every Christian should know this line. Why is it not coming to me? But the only part of it that's really sitting in my brain is the darkness has not overcome it. Light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not overcome it. That's what it is. John chapter one.
Yeah.
But I that idea of being, I don't want to say compelled. I want to say drawn into the darkness, not with the intent of absorbing it, but being present within it, I guess. And that notion of engaging with the very dark, very gritty side of life, which I think is sort of chaplaincy in a nutshell a yeah. lot of the time. But not being lost in it or glorifying it.
Right.
I guess. And that's a thought, I think, to turn this into a weird, like, Bible Devo moment. That's what I'm going to take away this week. That's what I'm going to take away from our Bible study this week is dwelling in that thought.
No, I dig it. Dwell away. For that is what comes in the winter.
Dwell away, ye darkness dwellers.
No, that's too redundant.
Fine. I'll workshop it.
You only get a little bit of redundancy as a treat.
MinMaxPod@gmail.com, MinMaxPod on all the socials except Reddit, where you're /these/MinMaxPodcast. 773-789-9369 is the voicemail number for voicemails 3 minutes or less. Anything over that, record the audio file and send it to our MinMax email. We have a Patreon, which is how Skip sent us his topic. You also can have a this, this, or that question, and there's also other tiers like mugs and t-shirts on there as well as just the general $1 tier of the Slack access, where you guys hear us mention it all the time. You just get in and chat with us, and basically all of our, most of our past hosts are in there. We also have, you have access to us in the general channels, and we basically can ask questions and generally cavort with other members of the Mampersand community. And I believe with that, we'll see you guys next week. Goodbye.